Good afternoon, committee. We'll make a slight altercation in our agenda schedule
This is unique altercation.
Foreshadowing. I think we may yet get to altercation.
I'm trying to keep you and Helen apart here. We'll move House Bill 2549 first on our agenda. So I'll ask Representative Richardson to come forward. And while he's doing so, Sal, will you kind of review everything for us?
Yes, members of the committee, as you recall, at the last meeting on February 23rd, it was a public hearing. Testimony was taken. At that time, there was an amendment that was given, and what you have before you today is -2, which Representative Richardson will show over in a little more detail. But essentially, more briefly, the amendments that were the bill was a proposed the essential lot of record bill, which would allow that property owners that had government restrictions or in that after the time they bought a piece of property that restricted the use of their property, most specifically putting a house in there, that they could set up a process where they could go in and apply to then go through to get an approval to be able to construct a dwelling. It would not allow any divisions of that property, so that's the major difference between this bill and 37. It would deal with just a single family dwelling on a piece of property. The amendments speak to the transferability of it. There was some terminology, I think, changes with some deletions and additions, and it highlighted that a process that would, if someone was going to serve to demand the local governmental entity about granting approval, that if involved more than one, that they would go through that. And a major thing would be the restriction or the reinterpretation, as was discussed in the last meeting, that oftentimes, I guess is probably the correct word, there are a number of times jurisdictions can change their particular zoning regulations, which can become restrictive. They can be at the direction of the state agency requirements, or it can be court challenges. The key word, I think, that was quite some time discussed was reinterpretation, which can be, again, driven by state agencies, court cases, or it was also brought up that sometimes it can be local jurisdictions, i.e. a county, that would had been perhaps not interpreting its own requirements one way, and the reinterpretation evolves and changes, and so now that is can put some property owners in a bind at times. So this would also include reinterpretations, not just the original language. And I think with that, I think that essentially covers a brief overview of the bill and its amendments, and I would defer to the chair. Commissioner, thank you.
Does any committee member need additional time to study the amendments? Seeing no requests, good afternoon, Representative Richardson, and officially we open the work session on House Bill 2549.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Dennis Richardson, State Representative for District 4, and a proponent for the amendments and for the passage of House Bill 2549. Mr. Lickey has thoroughly gone through the high points of the amendments that have been proposed. I would like to clarify just a couple of things or kind of reiterate a couple of points. One is on the reinterpretation issue. The goal of the bill is to allow a person who purchased a piece of property and had the right to build a home at the time that they purchased it to be able to have that right now if that right was taken away from them by land use law changes and they weren't compensated. So they ought to be able to do what they had the right to do when they purchased property. One area where there could be where that goal could be circumvented would be if a county were to say it may have been the case that they had a right to build on the time that they bought it back in 1986, but that interpretation that we were under at that point was wrong, and that we want to reinterpret the way it should have been back then, and if we were back then now, we would not let them do it. and so they would end up being able to prevent the issuing of a permit to build a home because of a reinterpretation of the law that existed back then. And we're saying, no, that's not fair. If the property purchaser had a right to get a permit at that time, then they can't lose that right because of a reinterpretation of the law a decade later. And so this can be beat to death, this bill, and perfection is hard to reach, and I can say for everyone that that's one of the reasons that we have a bicameral system, because whatever isn't perfect on this side is going to be brought up in the House Land Committee's review of this bill before they would allow it out of their process. But the goal is clear, that we're trying to allow people that had the right to build a home to have that right now. We've added to the amendments clarifying language so that a municipality couldn't say, okay, you can build the house, but when you sell the property, then we're going to require that you remove that house and put it back into the condition before you build it. That's not the will of the people. It's just fundamentally unfair to take away a person's rights to use their property without just compensation, without a hearing. And so all we're trying to do is focus on one small population of landowners in this state, those that bought a piece of property, wanted to build their home, and then didn't, and they delayed, and then lost that right because of land use laws changes. So with that, I would open to any questions.
Any questions of Representative Richardson?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Richardson, I appreciate your raising the issue, and since you brought it up, I want to make sure I really understand it. And I do understand the situation that I think you described with regard to the reinterpretation. And as we talked about it the last time we had a hearing on this bill, there are basically two categories of reinterpretation. If a county commission or county court 20 years ago interpreted its own ordinance one way, and now 20 years later there are three or five different personalities sitting on that commission or that court, and they say, you know, we're not changing the words on the paper, but we're applying them differently. I would agree with you that the property owner should not be subject to that kind of evolution or reinterpretation, to use your words. The area that I want to really make sure I'm clear on is, if a property owner had a piece of property with certain restrictions or zoning or other opportunities applying to that property, and a local jurisdiction like a county commission or a city council mistakenly said that that would allow you to, in this case, build a house, and it was later determined by a court of competent jurisdiction that that was in error and that, in fact, that property owner didn't have that right, do you still intend for this bill to grant them the right that they didn't originally have?
I believe that, Mr. Chair, members of the board, the difficulty with hypothetical questions is that they can become so involved that it's very difficult to answer without a hypothetical answer. And so what I think the best answer is to focus on a day and time. And so my belief is that this bill says that on the day that a property owner bought their piece of property, if they could have walked in, got a permit, hired a contractor, and started construction, then they ought to be able to have that permit today. Now, if a year or two later, or sometime after they bought the property, there was a change in interpretation through a court of competent jurisdiction or whatever, that change would only have applied to purchasers of property or people who were applying for permits after the date of that hearing. They wouldn't go back to somebody a year before and say, tear down your house. And so if there was a change in the interpretation subsequent to the time that the person bought the property, then that would only apply to people subsequent. And so this bill is designed to focus on the day that the person bought their property, whatever rights they had to build a house. It's not all rights, but if they had a right to build a house on the day they obtained their property, they should have that right now.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Representative Richardson and Representative Ackerman?
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chairman. The Representative Richardson and I had a brief comment, and I had some questions for clarification, Representative, on page 2 at about line 33. This is where the owner can seek review in circuit court if denied a permit. I think there's two ways to get to circuit court, either through a writ of review or through an appeal in a non-contested case. And in either instance, that does not require a jury trial. In fact, jury trials aren't required for those types of remedies. I'm trying to figure out, are you contemplating a different type of review in circuit court under which you would have an entitlement to a jury trial?
We are not, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, the goal is not to change judicial procedure in any way. And so if in the course of drafting there is a technical revision that needs to take place to comply with standard jurisdiction and judiciary procedure, civil procedure, then certainly we would expect that on the Senate side that would get taken care of.
Fine, thank you. I think that was basically what our consensus was. This was a technical problem, which I believe it is. We take care of it over there. Mr. Chair, if I may just make an inquiry. I have submitted another amendment, and I know it's not here yet today because I submitted it yesterday, and that was to limit the conveyance of this drilling permit to apply through inheritance only rather than conveyance to a third party. I'm willing to take that up on the Senate side when the when the amendment comes through in order to expedite Mr. Richardson's bill today.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman. Any further questions of Representative Richardson? Seeing none, thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I bring the written testimony given to the committee on the original hearing. Don Schellenberg with the Farm Bureau indicated that if there were any changes in the general provisions of this bill, he might not be able to remain in a neutral position. Don, I'm going to ask you to come forward, if you will, and state your interpretation of the amendments and whether the Farm Bureau can continue its not endorsement, but your neutral position.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing the Farm Bureau. The issue that came up last time when we had the hearing was this amendment in dealing with the issue that Representative Ackerman was talking about, and that's the transferability. If it was allowed to be transferred to family down the line, we wouldn't have a problem with that. The way I read the amendment is that they could transfer the right to build along with that property to anybody. We see that as capitalizing on a decision by the legislature. Doesn't have anything to do with simply making things fair, as Representative Richardson was just talking about. And I remember Senator Lindo had a committee hearing up at Hood River, and Representative Smith had a constituent there that was talking about everything being made fair. They had bought the property and they couldn't build on that property, and if it was just a bill that would allow them to build, that would be fair. And I think that's what the purpose of this bill is, and we don't have a problem with that. If transferability means conveyance in this case means that you can just transfer that right to build on that property to anybody you want to sell it to, then we've got a problem with that. I'm going to have to defer on what our position is on that issue, on the bill as it comes out of committee, with the current amendment, if the current amendment is adopted.
Very good. Thank you, Don. Any questions,
Chair?
Don, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
The committee will entertain a motion on the two amendments.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Smith.
Two amendments to be added to House Bill 2549.
Representative Smith has moved the -2 amendments into House Bill 2549. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Greenwood?
on the amendment?
Yes.
Aye.
Nolan?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Sumner?
Aye.
Trigger?
Aye. The dash two amendments are moved into House Bill 2549, and now the chair would entertain a motion on House Bill 2549 as amended.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I move the House Bill 2549 with the dash two amendments be moved to the floor with a DPAS recommendation.
Representative Anderson has moved House Bill 2549 to the floor with a DPAS recommendation, is there any discussion? Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote no on this bill, and I'd like to put a brief explanation of my no vote into the record. I met on Saturday morning in the rural part of my district with 100 of my constituents packed into the Helvetia Tavern at 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturday to talk about, and that was even before they were serving hamburgers, to talk about Measure 37. And there were two things that came up very clearly in that session. One is that they really did believe that when they had a right to build a house on their property, they ought to continue to have the right to build a house on the property. That was very clear with them. But what was also really clear is that they were worried about the whole question of Measure 37, our decisions on it and court decisions on it, and how that was going to affect their ability to maintain the agricultural industry of Helvetia, which is a strong agricultural industry, a traditional one back to the Swiss and Dutch families that settled that area so many years ago. I strongly favor us working together and creating an omnibus solution to make Measure 37 work. And I think that's a hard job. And I really think we need to be there to have all sides together and to keep all the chips in the pot while we're trying to figure out how to make this work, so that both the person that wants to develop a pear orchard in Hood River and the people around there who don't want to develop a pear orchard have a fair say in the game. I'm going to oppose any kind of piecemeal solutions to what I think is the problem until we have a sense in this committee or jointly with the Senate committee that we have the package of things we need to create a fair resolution to how to make Measure 37 work. And that's going to take some compromises on the part of Organs in Action, I believe, some compromises on the part of the cities and the counties, and some compromises on the part of the state, and some compromises on the part of 1,000 friends. I think this, but I have a lot of confidence in us and our process, and I believe we can do it. I'm afraid this bill, which is a key piece of that settlement, is going to take a little bit more pressure off trying to create the proper omnibus solution for it. I have some problems individually with the bill, but my biggest concern is moving this and taking this important piece out of the game before we really have all the pieces. So I really sympathize enormously with what this bill is trying to do, and my constituents, at least a large number of my constituents, want to make sure something like this happens. They also have really asked me to make sure we create some omnibus solution for it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Your comments are so noted.
Mr. Chair and member colleagues on the committee, I really appreciate the effort that I believe is behind this bill, and that is to bring some immediate relief, at least as it's been explained here, to bring some immediate relief and momentum to people who are almost certain to prevail in any Measure 37 claim for this very specific type of project. And I would like to support the bill and support that intention. But as I've explained to the chair, I don't think this bill achieves that goal, and I think it goes beyond that goal. And because of that, I think it actually muddies the water, and for some potential applicants may make their pursuit more difficult rather than less difficult. I would love to support this bill. I understand it's going to be changed on the Senate side, and as I've said many times, I'm voting today on the words that are on the page today, not what I think will come back from the Senate. I have raised concerns in hearings before about the expansion of some definitions under this bill from what are in current law and under Measure 37, and I am particularly troubled by the interpretation of the use of the word reinterpretation, which I believe has a very real potential to grant rights to property owners that did not exist before. And for those reasons, I'm also going to be voting no, but looking forward to an opportunity to vote yes on a new and improved version of this bill.
Thank you for your comments, Representative. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Dickman?
No.
Nolan?
No.
Smith?
Aye.
Sumner?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2549, as amended, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we will name Representative Richardson as the carrier. And we will now go back to our schedule and open a public hearing on House Bill 2544. And we'll ask Stephen Cafori. And Al Johnson to come forward, please, as our first panel. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Ackerman. We'll take Representative Ackerman first. I'm sorry, gentlemen. He's acting late.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Ackerman. I'm a state representative from North Eugene, representing Legislative District 13. My testimony today in support of this bill will be relatively brief because we will have a number of land use attorneys more skilled than I that will testify with respect to their version of this bill and what it attempts to accomplish.
Representative, should I might just ask you to pause for a moment and we'll have Sam read the bill to us. I forgot to do that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2544 is one that basically what it does is when a local government grants a decision, that decision can be appealed. That land use decision would be appealed to Legal Land Use Board of Appeals. If any parties feel aggrieved at that decision can then be appealed to the Court of Appeals. This particular bill will essentially deals with the appeals from Legal to the Court of Appeals, and it would modify ORS 197850 to currently the time for 49 days exists for the time for the Court of Appeals to have a hearing. This would increase it to 109 days.
Thank you. I'll start again, Mr. Chairman. It's unusual that court rules such as this are embodied in the statute. Usually the court sets their own rules, and we have a volume here of various rules of the various courts of this state. But since the time to obtain oral argument in a case before the Court of Appeals on appeal from RUVA is within the statute, that brings us here this afternoon. I want to give you just a brief overview of what the practice of law is like in the practical sense and why in some instances lawyers and parties have to seek extensions of time. As you can certainly envision, any law office having staff and vacations and personnel and emergencies come up from time to time. These are all items which require an alteration of your caseload. You also have really many, many conflicts because practitioners are usually not limited to one court. In Maine County for existence, for example, if I was still there practicing daily, my trial schedule in circuit court would have been already imposed upon me probably through May of this year, as well as any obligations I might have in federal court. If you're working in state and federal court and impose upon that your litigation requirements of LUBA, there's very many overlapping dates and overlapping issues that come down that occasionally require reasonable extensions of time. And I think that's basically what's behind the rest of the testimony here today, is the ability to find more reasonable time extensions, because as the testimony that will follow will show that the attempts to get time extensions from LUBA based upon this statute are extremely, extremely difficult. I note from some of the staff material that you have that in 2004 there were about 45 cases from LUBA to the Court of Appeals, and of course that's where we are here. Even if we thought that extensions were granted or warranted in 10% of the cases, we're not really radically affecting the caseload or radically affecting the timeline for making decisions in these cases. And you have to keep in mind, just because oral argument is set and takes place doesn't mean the court's going to rule within 30 days, 60 days, or 90 days. It's not unusual in these cases to wait 6, 8, 10, or 12 months for a decision. As I mentioned to you earlier, the court rules are usually set by the courts themselves and are bound in this little book that I have here. And I just want to cite some rules on appeals from trial court to circuit court. Rule 7.5 allows you almost an automatic 28-day extension, and then there are methods to get the second and third extensions from the Court of Appeals if you're appealing from circuit court to the Court of Appeals. I want to make mention of that to show that each court and each system has its own set of rules, and our rules here with respect to these LUBA appeals are extremely stringent, and some modification of the timeline within which oral argument should take place should be allowed, and the bill should receive favorable consideration. So that will conclude my testimony. Thank you.
Any questions of Representative Ackerman? Does this bill need to be amended, Representative? Do you need to make any changes in this bill?
Not necessarily. Unless the committee was of the opinion that the time we're seeking is too much, we might proceed by consensus and shorten the time and do a dash one amendment and move the bill. But I think that would depend upon your reading of the rest of the testimonies this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. Now I'll bring up the only guy against the bill. Stephen? Make you sit there all by yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Gafford. I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. Our association includes a number of land use lawyers as well as land use planners, as people generally who are interested in this process. I don't think bills get more arcane than this one, and I almost apologize to the committee that you're dealing with something that's really rarefied to battle between lawyers at this point. I'd like to briefly read to you a letter from Ed Sullivan. I'm sure you are familiar with him, as one of two or three preeminent land use lawyers in the state. And he said that he's been practicing land use lawyer in Oregon for 36 years and very familiar with the land use system. And I think this is the key sentence in the whole testimony. One of the most distinctive hallmarks of Oregon's land use system is the relative speed with which land use decisions are made and reviewed. That's really important. As we begin, one of the distinctive hallmarks of this system is the relative speed with which land use decisions are made and reviewed. An appellant has a statutory right to a decision from a local government within 120 to 150 days from the time the application is deemed complete. LUBA has an obligation to render a decision within 77 days after the it is settled. Similarly, the Court of Appeals has an obligation to render a decision within 49 days of the date LUBA record is transmitted to the court. Each one of these deadlines has an enforcement mechanism which is rarely being used. In other words, people adhere to these timelines. The habit of citing cases expeditiously has been ingrained in our land use system for over 20 years, and we think it's important to keep it. Without reading all of this, let me just say that as as I understand the situation, the reason that there are no continuances given now from the Court of Appeals is because the person who is now dead, former court appeals judge, was unhappy with some of the lawyers asking for what he considered to be unreasonable or frivolous continuances. And she said, we're not going to have any. We're going to do things right on schedule. The statute allows the rules to be made by the court. The court made a rule at that point and said, we're not going to allow any continuances. The court can, anytime they want, return that to the closer of having continuances. So I think the issue of allowing continuances on individual cases as individual circumstances come up ought to be, I think would be might, perhaps a good thing for this committee to write a letter to the Court of Appeals and say, we think it would be a good idea for you to change your rules. But for this legislature to automatically say all the timelines are going to be extended, for, regardless of whether they're extenuating circumstances or not, we think would be detrimental to the expedient land use process we have, and we oppose the bill.
Any questions of Mr. Kifori?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Greenwich.
Thank you, sir. Steve, thanks for coming today. I was hearing a thing about the budget constraints that the courts are under and their requests for attorneys. I don't know for sure, but I assume the appeals courts are under the same kind of pressure that we're seeing in the circuit courts now. If there are certain kinds of actions that have very stringent timelines and other kinds of action that don't have those stringent timelines, do we have a case of sort of Gresham's law with the bad currency driving the good currency out of circulation? I mean, are the ones that are going to get the proper attention the ones that have an artificially short timeline for the action on an appeal as opposed to others that don't have that time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenwood, you're asking the wrong person. I am not a land use lawyer. There are some land use lawyers who are going to come and talk to the ones that have particular speaking on at least looking for this or in favor of the bill. But I think you should ask that question of them. All I can say is that in talking to my clients, that was not an issue that was raised, and I have never heard that issue raised.
Thank you, sir.
Any further question?
Any comment?
I don't understand your question. I know that there are other areas of the law in which certain appeals are given priority. I can't pull those out right now.
And ones that aren't given priority. I mean, this has a 77-day time frame or whatever it is in the original law. There must be other things that don't have that. So if the appeals court is forced to deal with ones that do have a short time, does that prolong the time for other appeals that aren't?
I can't answer that. The court would have to really... I don't know what their prioritization is on rendering decisions. It really depends, I think, on the complexity of the case.
Mr. Chair, I think the answer is that if they find that they're having difficulty doing this within the time, they can change the rules by themselves. They don't need this legislature. They have legislative authority presently. I can read that if you'd like. The Court of Appeals has the power to exclude the following time under ORS 197-355-2B. Any reasonable period of delay resulting from a continuance granted by the court on the court's own motion or at the request of one of the parties, if the court granted the continuance on the basis of findings that the ends of justice served by granting the continuance outweigh the best interests of the public and the parties by having the decision within 91 days.
In the ever-ending quest to find the answers to Representative Greenwich's questions, could Mr. Miller come up here? And I think he has the answer. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Bruce Miller from the Office of the State Code Administrator, and I'm happy to try to answer any questions about the Court of Appeals.
I'll try my question again.
Sure.
The current statute requires you to hear oral arguments within 49 days and doesn't have any room beyond that. My assumption is that not all of the appeals that come before the court have a finite timeline, so that what I was wondering is if, because this has a finite timeline that's very, very specific, if that doesn't drive on the docket things out that the kind of appeals that may be equally or more important that don't have that same kind of finite timeline on them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, like, it doesn't drive those cases out, but if you think of the docket as something elastic, the more cases you get that have a high priority, then the further out it pushes the other cases. If we had a year where very few, say, Luba cases were filed with the Court of Appeals, then you would have a less effect on the rest of the docket. If you have a year where you have many Luba appeals filed, then you'll have a greater effect on the docket. We have a finite number of Court of Appeals judges. We can't go higher more, so they deal with what they can. By the way, they're very efficient. I think we're about the second most efficient in the nation, or second highest caseload in the nation.
I follow that just for a moment. So the effect of Representative Ackerman's proposal changing that first landmark, which is the oral cases, from 49 to 109 might give you more flexibility to prioritize things. That's where I was trying to go. So that the importance isn't only defined by a statutory requirement, it's defined by a variety of other things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, that's exactly right. And in fact, when this was implemented, it was a challenge and remains a challenge on occasion for the court to meet that, but they are able to meet it. But it makes setting your docket very challenging because some of these come in very quick. With the time change, and by the way, the court isn't taking a position on this bill, but with this change, it will allow them a little more flexibility in how they deal with their docket. And Mr. Chair, if I might address something else to clarify about the court's rules, and those are the Oregon rules of appellate procedure. Of course, the court can change those rules, and the rule as it is now is you have 14 days to file your brief after you've filed your petition. The reason for that is that oral argument has to be, by statute, within 49 days of when the record is transmitted by LUBA. There is a mechanism in the rule to allow continuance there, but you've still got that mechanism that makes it very difficult. So while the court, sure, they can change the rule, they have to be cognizant of how that interplays with the 49 days set out in statute. Assuming the bill were to go out with 109 day, then the court could change the rule and allow more time to file the brief.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Miller. We appreciate you coming forward. I'll go back to our schedule now. I have Doug DePriest and Zach Middage. By the way, committee, we have in your packet a letter dated March 2nd from Richard C. Stein that he asked that this letter be made a part of the record, and we're so doing so. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug DePriest. I'm an attorney in private practice in Eugene, Oregon. Before I get to my remarks, I'd like to bring the committee's attention that while I submitted a letter to you via fax yesterday, dated March 1, I subsequently sent a corrected version, and I just want to make sure the members of the committee have the corrected version in front of me. Thank you. I've been practicing land use law since 1977, over 25 years. My practice area is before local governments, LUBA, and the Court of Appeals, and we're dealing with the Court of Appeals process here today. And my geographic area is Lane County, Douglas County, Coos County, Curry County, primarily for the areas in which I practice in. The concept and motivation behind this bill is to address the extreme tightness of the requirements that are on the Court of Appeals for processing these particular types of cases. And Mr. Kapori did a good job about summarizing all of Mr. Sullivan's letter, summarizing the tight timelines that we have at the local government level, at the legal level, at the Court of Appeals level. This bill is not intended to make any significant change to the tightness of getting land use decisions out. What this bill would do is take one piece of it and take it from what I would characterize as being extremely tight to just being tight. The intent behind it is no more than that. In terms of what is the significance of the time period, Legislative Council's office drafted the bill. They helped come up with the time period. The notion is that if each side had the opportunity for 3.5 weeks extra on briefing, and the Court of Appeals would get an extra 10 days on looking at the briefs before the hearing, then you get at the time that's set in the bill. It is not a magic number. As has been mentioned, it's a bit unusual for the legislature to tell the court when its oral argument has to be held, and this bill addresses that statute, which is sort of a key point, because everything, as the prior speaker noted, everything has to back up from that, and it's unusual to have a brief due 14, at the appellate level 14 days after you filed your appeal. But because the court was responding to the legislature's mandate to hold these hearings, oral argument within 49 days, they backed up their schedule, said we need a week to look at the briefs. The respondent has 21 days to get their brief in. We know when the petition is filed, oops, there isn't even 21 days for the petitioner to put their brief together after they filed their petition. We only have 14 days. That is how tight it is. Representative Ackerman referred to the fact that different courts have rules for continuances, and in judicial appeals on circuit court cases, I believe you almost get an automatic extension of 26 days. We don't need an automatic extension of 26 days, but there is no ability to for extensions now, absent an extraordinary complex case or an emergency so serious that it's worth going through the mechanism that was described to request a special exemption. I have never had to do one, thank goodness, and I hope I never have to. Some say that since all parties are laboring under the same restrictions, that it's fair. It is exactly right that all parties are laboring under the same restrictions. This affects the development community, the development bar, opponent community, opponent bar, government community, government bar. But just because it's a restriction on all, it doesn't mean that the particular plan that we have now is desirable to keep it that tight and, in my view, shortened and flexible. In fact, as an illustration of the tightness, you could have a case in which the attorneys agreed that a continuance was appropriate. All the attorneys involved in the case agreed that somebody should have an extra 3 weeks to get their brief in. Under the current legislation, the court is, unless it fits into the complex case or the, you know, extraordinary circumstances, if it's just because the attorneys think it's good for the case or good for a party to do that, the court is powerless to grant that. And the point I want to make to the committee is that that is highly unusual. And the reason that this bill is before you is because we've had this unusual situation for 10 years. We have all lived with it for 10 years. As was indicated, the court lives with what the legislature says. But this tightness is not something that has gotten better with the passage of time. And the purpose of putting this bill before you is to bring that to your attention and to ask you for your assistance with that. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Any questions for Mr. DePriest? Seeing none, thank you, sir. And Mr. Middich.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Zach Mitke. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Hutchinson Cox. I'll reiterate too much of what Mr. DePriest has already said. I would like to make a couple of additional points, however, with regard, first of all, to the tightness of the timeline for the Court of Appeals to review these matters under the 49-day deadline. Presently, the Court of Appeals permits itself only 7 days to review these legal cases, some of which are very complex. This tight timeline, in essence, harms not only the litigants, but also the development of land use law at a certain level, because it doesn't provide the Court of Appeals ample time to really grapple with the issues, despite their best efforts, and I'm sure they are very efficient, as the prior speaker said. It essentially forces them to rush through materials that are complex and take a lot of time to elucidate, and requires that the court may not have the opportunity at oral argument to have its questions answered, those later arising that it may find on later and more steady review. Another important point to point out is that the 49-day deadline does not impact the timeline upon which the Court of Appeals hands down its decisions. There have been circumstances where decisions have been handed down up to 10 months after oral argument by the parties. So, while this, this may give the impression that is lengthening the process, the inverse may actually be true in this case. The Court of Appeals may not have the opportunity prior to oral argument to fully address the issues and have its questions answered, and as a result, their decisions may actually take longer to be made. I would also like to address one other issue, and that's with regard to the litigants of the committee's proceedings. Unlike circuit court proceedings, which involve a considerable amount of procedure, legal proceedings have a more flexible procedural component. We actually encourage pro se appearances to a greater extent than circuit court cases, such that parties may actually be representing themselves before the Land Use Board of Appeals and may not actually have counsel at the time a Land Use Board of Appeals decision is handed down. In that scenario, should they wish to have to be represented by counsel at the Court of Appeals level, the counsel that they select or that they seek would be on a very tight timeline indeed to determine whether appeal is warranted in a particular circumstance and what the merits of a brief would be in that circumstance. That's the only issues I have to address at this time. So any questions?
Anybody have any questions? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you for your time.
Al Johnson? Alan, we only have one other person to speak. That's John Chandler, but I don't want to bring him up here when you.
I don't think he wants to sit with me. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Al Johnson, and I too, like Doug, am an attorney with practice concentrated in land use, and we've been practicing about the same amount of time. My practice is all over the state, and
Mr. DePriest and my other colleagues in that field, I live with the pressure that has given rise to this bill. I don't like that pressure. Doug doesn't like that pressure. None of us do. But most of us understand the reasons for the tight schedule that the legislature has imposed on these appeals. And so I'm here today in sort of a semi-neutral position to say that if there is to be a relaxation of the current schedule, and I'm not opposed to the idea of some relaxation, it really ought to be by a lesser time than that, a couple weeks or a month, and not by more than doubling the current time frame for getting to oral argument. I've been a lot to explain why, but a couple of things. One is the effect on litigants, and the other has to do with the way in which the whole land use appeals process is structured. In my practice, although I occasionally represent opponents, most of my clients are people or institutions that are seeking approvals. I represent low-income housing authorities, counties, cities, school districts building high schools, a variety of private developers of various kinds, and for all of them, time is extremely important. Sometimes it's a matter of money, it's often a matter of a building season, it's often a matter of staying qualified for various kinds of certificates you need to get federal grants of various kinds. Time is extremely important to the proponent of a land use project, almost without exception. And there is a tremendous amount at stake for these people. And depending upon how much risk there is, they're either going to do the project here, or they're not going to do it here, or they're not going to do it at all. So decisions are made to have a broader impact than just the litigants. On the other hand, the oppositions, they very often do also have a substantial stake, but in many cases they don't. Land use laws in this state allow almost anybody to be in opposition, and you don't have any particular responsibility as long as you don't ask for a stay, and when you ask for a stay, your responsibility is limited to $5,000. Very often you don't have to have any particular fact or liberal insight or sound, the kind of effect that has to be shown even under the UTSI decision, which is a case in which my client prevailed, is very, very low. So waiting around is really not a problem. Delay is a very cheap and very effective tactic for an opponent. So the field is really tilted in that sense. That's why it's important to have real deadlines that really mean something. I have two recent cases that I've discussed in my materials that I've given to you, just a two-page handout that illustrate the importance of timely appellate action. One was the UTSI case. That was a case which I technically won, but while the courts were struggling with this difficult decision, they gave themselves the waiver. It took a year to make the decision. And then there was a petition for review in the Supreme Court. The LCDC lawyer stepped in, assigned a new lawyer who said she was going on vacation for the summer for the AG's office, and over my objections, the Supreme Court granted her the extra 2 or 3 months it took. In my objections, I explained to the court that if you open this box, you're going to kill a cat. They opened the box. What had happened, basically, was the business opportunity that my clients were in the case for in the first place passed by, and so we asked to have the case dismissed. We withdrew our application, and the case became moot. It just went away. That's what happens when you're the applicant. It's very important to get a decision early, even if that decision is a no. The second case that's discussed there illustrates that point. That's the Peace Health case. In the Peace Health, which is the hospital relocation case in Eugene and Springfield, I represented the Jaquas, who were the opponents in that case. We won several legal rulings at the Land Use Board of Appeals and Court of Appeals. We won them rapidly. The Court of Appeals processed that case very quickly. The Lubis decision came down in January. The Court of Appeals decision came down in June. As a result of that, as the applicant, Peace Health, our opponent, was able to go back and address those issues by filing a new application, correcting the mistakes that it made, some of them, not all of them. At the same time, we had answers from the court and from the Land Use Board of Appeals that gave us leverage to negotiate what we think is a pretty good settlement. That case is now over. It's done with. Both clients got something out of it. The most important thing both sides got in that case was prompt answers. The last point I want to make is that it has to do with the nature of land use process, and others have talked about sort of the details of that. But the important thing to understand is that Oregon's land use process is one which has several levels each level has a fairly tight set of deadlines, but there are many, many levels, and there are many, many ways in which things can go wrong at any level and be stretched out. Cases go up, they go back. Notices don't get given in exactly the right way, and somebody can file an appeal 10 years later. I've described some of those problems that are technical problems with the process overall in my second page with some examples. Those are the issues that need to be addressed. I would very happily support the extension of this to 109 days, even 190 days, if some of those more substantive problems with the process could be addressed. You should not be able to attack any land use compatibility statement that somebody got for an agency 10 or 15 years after that statement was issued and relied upon by the state agency and the applicant, just because some local government didn't recognize that it was a land use decision at that time to give the proper notices. You shouldn't have it unknown when you go from the Land Use Board of Appeals to the Court of Appeals whether or not the Land Use Board of Appeals decision is still even in effect. In one of the JAQUA cases, in another major case we had involving the land use code update in Eugene, the parties in LUBA, everybody agreed that nobody knows, as of this date, what happens when LUBA remands a county, a local land use amendment, a whole county code, or a whole city code, or a comprehensive plan amendment. When LUBA remands that, we all know that that is not effective. But what if, until it's adopted again, but what if somebody appeals the LUBA decision? Nobody knows at this time whether or not that code remains in effect during that appeal process. If you don't know what the law is, it's really important to find out what the law is soon. That's why those deadlines are important. Now, if you can find out, if the legislature is willing to answer that question so that we know one way or the other what the law is while things are on appeal, it becomes less important. There are other issues of the same kind that are there, and I would be very happy to work with the committee, with anyone else, in getting at some of those most structural issues. The fact that this particular bill has a relating clause that deals with the appellate process in general would allow us to deal with some of these important technical issues in a way that I think is likely to get lost between the big look and Measure 37. I hope that this session of legislature does take time to address some of these basic ongoing issues. We have an excellent land use appeal system, but it's a very, very complex one. There are some things that need to be fixed. This is actually fixing something which, if it's wrong, it's one of the minor things that's wrong. And I'd like to get at the more basic issues. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Committee have questions of Mr. Johnson. Representative Ackerman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let's see, case which you referenced in the first page of your testimony, you say the Court of Appeals granted itself a waiver of a statutory time. That's not the type of time we're talking about here today, are we? It's a different type of time period.
That's right, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman. What happened there is that after oral argument, the Court of Appeals issued a pro forma order, which it does very rarely, but does do from time to time, stating because of the complexity of the case, it was extending the time for it to issue its final decision.
And how long was that waiver of time?
It did not have a date on it. In the event, it was a year.
All right. And then you mentioned later that the Supreme Court granted LCDC months of extra time to file a petition for review. That's not the type of time limit we're talking about here this afternoon, is it, in this
No, case? Again, Representative Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that is not this particular time limitation.
That's correct. What was the time limit granted by the court in that case?
The action taken by the Supreme Court?
Yes.
The Supreme Court extended the time of, I think it was originally, the petition was originally due toward the end of May, and the court granted an extension until, I believe, sometime in October. I'm not...
4 or 5 month delay?
Yeah, about 2 months in that case.
Fine. Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. John Chandler? Why is it every time I introduce you, John, Jingle Bells keeps going in my head, and I...
Mr.
Chairman, members of the committee, I guess that's better than Big Rock Candy Mountain, which goes along with the Bar Lives riff, maybe every now and again.
Proceed, Mr. Ives.
Thank you, sir. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I would like to start by apologizing to Representative Ackerman, because normally if I'm going to oppose a member's bill, I tell them beforehand. This is somewhat rude, but I'm opposing House Bill 2544. And you've heard arguments from Mr. Johnson and Mr. Kefouri. I want to talk a little bit. This has a very high glaze factor, I understand, so I'm going to try to be brief. The land use system in Oregon is a very delicately balanced set of a deal, if you will. One of the deals, implicit deals, is we have a fairly wide open citizen a friendly process at the local level, at the appellate level, where you don't have to show much to get into LUBA, for example. You don't have to have a lawyer. You don't have to necessarily say why you're grumpy. You can simply say, I'm grumpy. You can get standing by writing a letter. You don't have to show up. And all of that is fine. As a matter of public policy, we said we want our land use system to be accessible. In exchange for that, if you will, none of this is written down as a set of quid pro quos, but as part of that delicate balance. In exchange for that, you get pretty fast time frames. You have 120 days at the local level for a decision. They can have all the process they want at the local level. They've got 120 days to do it. You have a very short time frame at the Land Use Board of Appeals. You have, as this bill indicates, a very short time frame at the Court of Appeals. And with all due respect to the proponents of the bill testimony you heard here, I'm not sure what problem we're fixing. Yes, it is a short time frame. Yes, a deliberately short time frame. It's designed to be a short time frame because the public policy issue is we want to have a lot of involvement. We want to get decisions made quickly. As Mr. Johnson indicated, for my clientele, which tend to be the recipients of appeals more than the instigators, getting the answer quickly is critical. As Mr. Johnson said, a fast no is oftentimes much, 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 much better than a prolonged yes. And I understand the concerns of the appellate bar. I practiced law for a number of years. I understand the time frames very well of having to get briefs out and do the research. But this is a portion, what this bill addresses is a piece of, it's one of the sticks in that delicately balanced little deal. And I would encourage the committee, if we're going to talk about this, to do so in the broader context of other changes to the system, getting some information about how many cases actually run into this 49-day problem, whether an extension is more than double. Maybe we can, if there's a problem, and I'm not saying there is or isn't, but if there's a problem, I'm not sure doubling the time frame is the right response. I'm certainly open to having a conversation, and I think it's a good one to have because the last thing we want is to have a dysfunctional appellate process. On the other hand, during the interim, there was an extended work group looking at a whole bunch of different things involving the permitting process in Oregon, economic development in Oregon. One of the elements is the land use permit and land use appeal system. And there's several bills floating around this process. I don't recall if they're House or Senate bills dealing with this process. A couple of them talk about getting rid of the Court of Appeals step entirely, elevating LUBA to be a branch of the Court of Appeals in a sense, so that the land use appeal would go from there directly to the Supreme Court. Those are all good conversations to have. I think all of us would share the interest in making sure the system works smoothly, efficiently, but certainly from my client's perspective, quickly is operative. I'm certainly glad if you do set up more process on this, more conversations. I'd be glad to talk to Representative Ackerman or anybody else about what changes we can make that would still occur within that context of speedy, quick, and part of that deal. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll hush. I'd be glad to take any questions the committee might ask.
Seeing none, you're off the hook, John.
Clean living.
Fast talking.
Representative Ackerman, would you go back out for a moment so that I can ask you whether you were...
Once you're in the hot seat.
The judiciary, so I'm just kidding. It's all it is. Fair is fair.
It's all it is. Payback time.
Representative, are you open to a discussion with Mr. Chandler as far as amending this bill?
Well, only with respect to the time limits. I think if we open up the entire procedural process before LUBA, I think that's more than we can endure this session with Measure 37 coming down. I know that Lane Shetterly in his report to the legislature suggested a task force during the summer to look at all aspects of land use, and that might be a better time to fit the procedural requirements in. But it's extremely complex. and also dealing with the fact that the court has its own, within its own inherent power, has a power to make rules, and it's awfully hard for us to make rules for the court. So I would just recommend caution at this time. I'd rather stick with the bills before us and see if there's a consensus among the committee about the time extension. If not, whether we can work out a compromise very quickly on that. So I'd like to keep it with respect to the bill.
Okay. Any questions other than mine? Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2544 and open a work session on House Bill 2458. Dan, you want us to give us the...
Yes, I'm shuffling papers looking for everything, myself included. House Bill 2458 is the bill which deals with the industrial lands outside the Willamette Valley and outside city limits. It is one, the House bill would allow also commercial as well as industrial lands. Amendments have been received just late this morning, just before lunchtime, to that bill. You have before you two, dash one and dash two. Dash two came in just before lunchtime, so dash one has gone through the revenue and fiscal impacts. Essentially, the dash two is one which comes from the more recent one comes from the Oregon Association of Realtors, and it has some notable changes that I'll just go through real quickly. Deals with some population changes within the bill itself. It also has a provision for limiting for where the siting of the, and these are the abandoned mill sites or diminished mill sites that could be converted for industrial and or commercial as in the bill. They would be limited to 5 miles outside of a city's urban growth boundary. So that's in lines 10 through 13 in through there. The last major provision, I think, is at the end, which allows that essentially not that the areas that are currently zoned for industrial use, nothing in the section allows an area zoned for industrial use to be used for commercial use, for an area zoned for commercial use to be used for industrial process. And I think essentially it's saying that if the land is designated county land that's has an industrial designation that is currently there and doesn't have one of these diminished sites, that would be limited to the industrial use only, and it could not become considered for this. This only considers the abandoned mill sites in the dash two. But I would think for more discussion, might want to have the authors of that particular amendment speak in greater detail.
Anybody signed this?
I think we
have a signed. There's
nobody signed.
Yet.
Oh, this is a work session.
Okay. Harlan Levy. And could I have Linda, please come forward also? And you might as well come up too.
This was a bill that we
heard on February 16th, and we asked this group to get together and come back and see if they could work out an agreement. So that's what we're here today to do, is to find out whether you have been able to reach some sort of accord on House Bill 2458, and to discuss perhaps the effect of your dash twos, which hopefully represents the compromise. Harlan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, senior staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors, here to comment on the Dash 2 amendments, as well as to provide you with some answers to some questions that were raised at the last hearing. That is the written handout that I have given you. First, I want to thank both Linda and Art, as well as Doug Riggs, for meeting with me to try to work this thing out. I would recommend that we brought before you is the result of that meeting, and I hope that it is satisfactory to all the parties involved. It is satisfactory to the Oregon Association of Realtors. First, wanted to comment on the amount of land that we are talking about here. Excuse me. That was raised in the last hearing, and in my handout to you, I have presented you with some written comments that I put together, as well as some documentation that I pulled out of one of my old files from the last session. This was documentation that came from the Department of Land Conservation and Development that lists the acreages of privately owned land outside of urban growth boundaries in all 36 counties of the state. Again, a lot of this is approximations rounded to the nearest 10,000, but it gives you a ballpark idea of what we're dealing with. What I've done is I've gone and highlighted the counties that are affected by this bill, namely those counties outside the Willamette Valley, and I've gone and totaled the commercial and industrial up for you. And what we end up with, the total acreage affected by this bill is about 43,400 acres out of a total of 21,390,000 acres. That is equivalent to about 0.002% of the privately held land outside of urban growth boundaries. That is a very minuscule amount of land that we are talking about here. The second issue that I wanted to briefly discuss was another question that was raised at the last hearing was, thank you. I got a frog in my throat today. The second question that was asked was, did 2614, the bill that was passed last session, actually result in any job creation around the state? And I have a closed attached a copy of Mr. Schlatt's testimony that he presented to you on House Bill 2162, in which the counties state that 94 jobs were created in Hood River County, at least 10 jobs were created in Umatilla County, and then additional jobs undetermined at this point. So we're talking about at least over 100 jobs here. And again, that bill has only been effective since January 1st of 1994. So we expect it to continue to be productive for the counties to be able to facilitate the creation of jobs in these parts of the state that need it the most. At this point, I would like to discuss the amendments. If it's the chair's pleasure, I can do that.
Does any committee members have questions to this point? Seeing none, I proceed to the amendments, please.
Thank you. What we've done here is we have tried to deal with some of the city's concerns with respect to the commercial lands. Well, the first thing that we did is we're dropping the population threshold. As you can see, land that is outside of an urban growth boundary with 20,000 individuals or more, you would not be able to site any one of these projects within 3 miles of those cities. We've gone from 25 to 20, so that will add several new cities to this list of cities around which you could not take advantage of this bill. The second thing that we've done with respect to commercial projects that get approved by this is we've required that these commercial projects not be approved within 5 miles of every city unless the city concurs with the county that it is a use that they are okay with. And that would specifically deal with the situation we've talked about out in Umatilla County, where the cities are very much in favor of allowing these commercial uses. The next thing that we did was we specified that this bill is not to allow any conversion of industrial land to commercial use or vice versa. That had never been the intention of this bill, nor was it the intention of House Bill 2614 last session. This spells it out clearly for everybody to see. And then finally, the last thing that we did in the amendment is we specified that those types of commercial projects that the counties currently can approve under existing law would not be affected by this new limitation that we've created here to give cities an ability to say no if it's within 5 miles. Existing commercial development that cities or the counties want to approve under existing law would not be altered in any way by this bill. How is that different from
it's impolite to whisper in front of the committee.
I'm sorry, Chair Garland.
Ms. Ludwig was asking me a question and I wasn't reading her. I think maybe she should talk to the committee about that issue. I kind of with that, I think we've gone through those. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have with respect to any members.
Representative Smith.
I have a question, Holland. I hate to make you talk. Can you give me an example of the three or four cities that changed when you went from the 25 to the 20,000? Where were they?
Give you an example of...
Just the you said there was three or four cities that were excluded.
Chair Garrard, Representative Smith, yes, I've got, or Linda has a list here of city populations. So we'd be talking about cities that are over 20,000, but less than 25,000 outside the valley. And those cities include Grants Pass, Ashland, Roseburg, and Klamath Falls. Well, that's 18 years.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Green.
I have just a general question. I was talking about this bill to a constituent, and he asked, why would a county, what are the conditions under which a county might designate land, say, as commercial somewhere more than, let's see, commercial is 3 miles, more than 3 miles from the city limit, or industrial? I mean, what would a county have in mind when it create, say, an industrially zoned site between Condon and John Day, for example, something like that. What?
Excuse me, but I have a perfect answer for you. It's called Gel Gwyn, which employs about 500 people and have built an industrial site and employ about 500 people about 18 to 19 miles north of Klamath Falls on Highway 97. So that's
it was just a logical site.
It was a site that was used for various other things previously, and so it was in existence, and simply now is being used.
And switched to a
correct
industrial use.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if
I did understand that the mill sites were a piece of this originally. That I understood.
What? Art?
Art Slack with the Association of Warren Counties. Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlight, when the counties went through the process of developing their plans consistent with the statewide planning goals, there were numerous sites that were in the county, unincorporated areas, that historically had been developed for commercial or industrial purposes. And those were the sites that generally, those are the sites that were picked up as being developed and committed. Now, most of the sites that you'll see have some kind of development, some development of a magnitude on them today, but in terms of the mill sites, they had mills on them in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. Some of those have gone away, but these commercials are the smaller sites that were the area grocery store, maybe the post office, those were picked up as developed and committed. So those are the sites that we're talking about, those sites that are currently planned and zoned.
If I may just continue. So, it wouldn't be something...
Nice of you to ask for permission to talk.
I do.
I said it's nice.
Yeah, I just assumed you. It's because you're so nice. May I...
Proceed.
Thank you, sir. Okay, so I got a couple of blank passes. I could use what I forget. So this isn't like the county looking at the map between Condon and John Day and saying, oh, wouldn't it be nice to plunk a site 60 miles from either of them? They're basically there for a reason and for some historical reason. And
Mr. Chair, and Representative Greenwood, that's correct. These are historical sites at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Representative. Art, since we have you there, your comments on the amendments, are you okay with them?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we are okay with the dash two amendments.
Ms. Ludwig?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities. We very much want to thank the Chair and Mr. Levy for allowing us the opportunity to work with this bill. As you heard in my prior testimony, we did have some issues with the unamended version of 2458, and the Dash 2 amendments do take us down the road to feeling a bit more comfortable. It was a middle ground for us and didn't go quite as far as we had hoped, but the bill reads much better in terms of the municipal position with the Dash 2 amendments.
Thank you. Thank you for working together and bringing in the Dash 2s today to make this bill, enable this bill to go forward. We appreciate your efforts.
Thank you.
The Chair would entertain a motion on the Dash 2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion that we move the Dash 2 amendments.
Representative Smith moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2458. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Freeland?
Aye.
Nolan?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Sumner?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. The Dash 2 amendments are made a part of House Bill 2458. And now we'll entertain a motion
on
House Bill 2458. Representative Smith.
On the House Bill 2458, to the floor with the due pass as amended.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 2458 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman? Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Freeman?
Aye.
Nolan?
No.
Smith?
Aye.
Sumner?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Would Representative Smith like to carry this bill?
I will.
Representative Smith will carry House Bill 2458. It's now moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2458. Committee, enjoy your last Friday, because I think this will probably be the last Friday you have off from this committee for a while.
Thank you.
But enjoy it, and we'll see you back here on Monday. Thank you. Representative Greenwood.
The Elections Committee is starting a road show around the state, which will take me away if I sent to which I go to them on several of the Fridays in the next few. So,
well, we'll be delighted. We'll be delighted not to see you here.
Speed up the process a little bit.
We'll be delighted. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Perhaps, Mr. Chair, I could take lessons in interrupting our speakers from the good representative from the West.
Excellent. The House Committee on Land Use is adjourned.
Personally.